This is the Best Run Podcast, brought to you by SAP.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to today's edition of the Best Run Podcast, brought to you by SAP. Today, we've got Tom Nash with us, and I'm very excited to have Tom with us. He's going to be talking to us about overcoming adversity to be your best. Now, Tom, at the age of 19, lost both his hands and both of his legs to a deadly disease. Since then, he has rebuilt his life using prosthetics to master tasks that many able-bodied individuals often take for granted. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Ruschenka. I really appreciate it.
Now, we're going to have a look into your life, not in too much detail, but just enough.
Yeah, how long is your podcast?
And look at problem solving when faced with adversity, and then also look at innovation, which is something that we're going to be discussing at our upcoming events for EFFECT. So, Tom, let's do a little intro about who you are and what you do in your professional life.
Yeah, so as you sort of pointed out in your introduction there, I went through a bit of a hurdle when I was 19, lost both arms and legs. And since then, I have become a DJ, and I had a career in the music industry for ongoing now for about between 15 and 20 years, depending on where you want to draw the line. And then lately as well, in the last sort of 5 years, I've been doing a lot of public speaking and business consultancy and things like that. And that kind of brings us up to speed of what I do with myself these days.
So from what I've read, your life story is truly amazing. So perhaps you could share with our listeners what life is like for you in the early years when you were faced with a life-threatening illness.
Sure. So early on, I was a pretty average middle-class teenager, I guess. I had an upbringing primarily here in Australia, and I just went to high school, and I really liked music. That was a kind of a creative outlet for me. I used to play guitar, things like that. And then I went to university here in Sydney, and during my first year, that's when I contracted meningococcal disease, which is a kind of a blood poisoning, if you will, that causes septicemia, and then you have to start amputating limbs after too long to stop it from spreading. And so as a result, I was in hospital for about 18 months in total, and the split over three or four different hospitals. And so it spanned the range of being on life support for a while of it to going into the burns unit in Concord here in Sydney, because they sort of treat the effects on your skin that the meningococcal has much like they treat burns. And they also did the amputation. So I had both of my legs amputated below the knee and both of my arms through the elbow. And that meant living the rest of my life with prosthetics, which was something that I didn't really know existed. Well, I knew that prosthetics existed, but I didn't know in what kind of capacity they could be used and to what effect at that point. And so I didn't know whether I'd be able to walk again with two prosthetic legs or how much independence I would have using prosthetic arms, no less. And the latter year of the hospital period was all about learning how to walk again with prosthetic legs, getting the arms and becoming independent and mastering basic tasks that everybody does from childhood, picking up cups and learning how to feed yourself and all sorts of different things. And so that was that 18-month period of my life when I was just 19. And then since then, it's been kind of using those lessons of regaining independence and learning everything for a second time that I guess really laid out the trajectory of my adult life a little bit differently.
And what are some of those life lessons that you sort of learnt and what you try to pass on to others today?
A lot of life lessons, there have been plenty, but I think one that stands out more than any other is, you know, I often get told by people that they look at what I've been through and they say, well, I could never have gone through that. And it's actually one of the most annoying things to hear, because I always think to myself that if you can gain anything from viewing my experience, is that human beings are capable of much more than we presume we are. And it would certainly have been the case that before I'd lost arms and legs, I would have thought that I couldn't get through such adversity. You know, but it turns out we're a lot more strong than we think we are. And I think if anyone, if everyone could sort of take that from my story, it would sort of imply a sense of confidence to people that they could get over a lot more than they expect they could.
Now, you've obviously got a very good sense of humour that I identify with. So I know you're known for your TEDx talk called The Perks of Being a Pirate.
Mm.
And that has over 2.6 million views. So can you tell us what that talk was about?
Yeah, absolutely. So The Perks of Being a Pirate, I'm not even sure where I came up with that name, but I know that because I have hooks for hands, kids often will ask me whether I'm a pirate. Just tell them that I am. Which elicits a much better facial response than if you tell them you're not. But as in an overarching sense, the perks of being a pirate is more about the advantages to having a disability, and extended beyond the obvious advantages of, you know, never really having to look too far for a good parking space, but more to do with things like, as I was mentioning before, relearning everything that you'd ever cultivated, right? And it kind of forces you to look at problems from a different angle, because you learn that even though you have to be able to relearn everything that you've ever done, you have to relearn it in a different way. And so you have to achieve the same result using a different action or using a different angle. And the analogy that I use in the talk is, which was a real world example, which was when I started learning how to walk again. You walk on flat ground for the most part until such time as you are proficient at walking on flat ground. And then you start to tackle things like inclines or steps. And steps are a disproportionate challenge, I guess, because as I learned with prosthetic legs, you don't have ankle movement, which is the joint that is required to go up and down stairs. We usually do this as humans with a sense of automaticity, and you don't think about the joints that you use when you go up and down steps. And so I'd tried for weeks and weeks to get up the curb, which was the first step, you know, and it just wasn't working. And it was because I kept doing it the way that I'd always known how. And it wasn't until I broke down the problem and thought to myself, well, the issue is stemming from the fact that I don't have this joint. I need to move myself perpendicular to the way that I was facing and use a different joint like my hip to be able to clear this curb. And I was able to step up on this curb immediately. I realized that the friction that I was experiencing wasn't one of these, you know, just keep trying tropes that we hear, you know what I mean? Like, if at first you don't succeed, which, if we're being honest, if you want to do something, if you want to get up a step, you don't necessarily need to keep trying the same way that you did all the time. You really just want the result. And so working backwards from what you want that result to be, breaking down the problem and working out different ways of doing it, can often be a much more efficient way of problem solving than path dependency. And so I guess the talk is about looking at problems from different angles. And it's something that disabled people, I think, are particularly good at because they're forced to. And, you know, when you combine these approaches with problem solving, like disabled people sometimes have the ability to sort of dwarf the significance of more trivial hurdles as a result of having to get over what appear to be greater problems. And I think that breeds creativity and resilience and even anti-fragility and, you know, agents who can weather those storms.
I guess the global pandemic has seen a lot of people try to relearn a lot of things and also to face adversity in their own ways. What's one thing that you've been telling yourself to get through this pandemic?
I guess I have been telling myself a lot about taking this time as an opportunity and taking it as an opportunity to kind of reset and reprioritize and to think more broadly about how things are changing and what kind of value we can offer in the potential future. I'm a really big fan of kind of framing techniques, and framing techniques are great in the sense that you can take negative vicissitudes and put a positive spin on them. And it's not a case of sort of lying to yourself about the realities of your life, but, you know, you're always free to tell yourself a different story about the past or even the present. And it's really easy to collapse into despondency once you're faced with adversity. But it's often just as easy to try and look at things as an opportunity or a learning experience. And so, yeah, I guess I've looked upon this period as a time to reset and to find opportunities in a changing world and how we might be able to take advantage of them.
Yeah, and I hear and I've read that a lot of people, you know, some enjoyed parts of being locked down because it gave them a lot more time to actually enjoy time with their family, to take advantage of the outdoors, to not rush around like a crazy person.
And even from a company's perspective as well, I think there's been a lot of businesses out there, at least through my own experience, that have learnt the value of having a distributed workforce as well.
Yeah. Did you want to talk a little bit more about that?
That's pretty much just the point in that, you know, sometimes that path dependency that we were sort of discussing before, you know, forces institutions or organizations or systems to remain the way they are. And it's the fact that, you know, the first person to make change or innovate always pays a disproportionate price for doing so because they take the biggest risk. But the pandemic, in a way, when it comes to distributed workforces, has kind of forced everybody to experiment with situations in, let's say, people would work from home or work from abroad or a combination of the two. And that's kind of great in a way because for some companies it works, for some companies it doesn't, but it really forces them into a situation in which they have to test it. And if you think about it right now, I mean, we're chatting over Zoom, which wasn't possible, you know, 15 years ago or something like that, which in the grand scheme of things is a drop in the ocean. We have the infrastructure there to be able to work in this way and to be able to collaborate. And I think people are often really bad at judging the opportunity cost of not doing things. So everybody talked about how much they hate Zoom meetings when it all started and online meetings became a thing. I realized a few things about my own industry because I was kind of the same. I mean, I think everyone was the same in that, you know, you've always got that problem where there's, you know, the guy that is my mic working, tap, 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 right? And fine, you know, get used to it because it's here to stay. But if we didn't change to doing work like that, what kind of opportunities would we have missed? I mean, I've talked to so many small to mid-sized businesses now abroad that wouldn't have been able to get me over to talk to them if not for the fact that we can now do it over video. And they're only doing it over video because there's a pandemic. Do you know what I mean? So knock-on behaviors often force people to think differently and restructure in the same way that I was forced to relearn everything that had ever happened to me. You know, the world has kind of gone through something that has pushed them into and put pressure on them in certain situations to be able to innovate and to be able to change the way that things happen. And I think that there'll be a lot of positives to come through that.
Yeah. And besides a distributed workforce, obviously, you know, in your business, you come across a lot of leaders. What are some of the other challenges they're facing and what is the fundamentals that you suggest that they could look at from a problem-solving perspective?
So, I mean, I would say that harking back to that not relying on path dependency thing is a big one. I mean, at the end of the day, leaders are dealing with people and people don't often act rationally. And rationality is, you know, when acting rationally exclusively, it's almost impossible to act irrationally. Like humans' needs are a particularly interesting thing because the needs of humans are often needs that humans themselves can't identify because they often lack the introspection required to solve those needs. And so those needs remain unmet. And so leaders kind of need to try out things that may not make sense. You know, don't disincentivize wacky ideas, let's say. Try problem solving in reverse, just as we talked about it, like looking at the end result of a problem, breaking it down into smaller problems, and then working out a completely different way of doing things that doesn't rely on path dependency. Understanding, I think, that people's behaviors aren't always best explained by rational or economic predictions is the first step into trying things that sound crazy. Like when you test things that don't make sense, the advantage of it is if it does work, you'll be the only one doing it. You become unique. If you act rationally and you do the same thing that everyone else is doing, you end up in the same place as everybody else. And that's not really what innovation is about.
Great. So you are going to be speaking at an event series called Effect, which is actually yes. We had our first event just happen. But that's all about innovation. And we're very excited to have you speak at our Sydney event on the 2nd of December. Can you share with us what resonates around innovation to you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to be I'm very excited to be talking about this because innovation is one of the things that I love talking about. And the reason that I think it's pertinent to someone in my particular situation is that I think disability and innovation are intrinsically linked in a way, right? I mean, you know, the whole trope of necessity is the mother of all invention. I mean, nobody knows this better than people with a disability. And when you design things with universal access in mind, no matter at what level, maybe it's you know, infrastructure or software or anything, you almost always get unintended positive effects. Like a good example of this would be cuts in sidewalks and curbs, which were designed for people in wheelchairs, immediately become useful to people pushing prams and strollers. All right. Another example of this would be there are building regulations in the United States and many other countries such that commercial buildings need to have door handles rather than circular doorknobs. Now, let me tell you, as a person that uses hooks for hands, I have been stuck in one too many bathroom cubicles because the door handle is circular and I can't get my hook around. It's ridiculous, right? And so the regulation is such that for people with disabilities, we have the door handle that's pushed down, right? Fantastic. Very useful for people with a disability, but also useful if you're carrying a couple of lattes for you and your colleagues because you can use your elbow to open the door. Completely unintended positive effect of universal access. So better examples of this would be audiobooks. Now, audiobooks were created actually initially on record for people who were blind. Blind people could not read books and they invented a very early version of an audiobook which was on record. Interesting point about that as well that I read fairly recently, which was that a lot of blind people actually hacked their record players so they could listen to audiobooks at a high speed. And that's kind of the first incantation of that. Now we can have the option when we have Audible or something from Amazon and we're listening to a book, you have the ability to listen to it at twice the speed. You can do this with podcasts or anything so you can consume content quicker. And things like electrical hearing aids, which were the first principal sight component for miniaturization of chips, compact assembly. And this was pre-World War II. So after the World War, hearing aids became the first consumer market for printed circuits, transistors, and integrated circuits. And it was all due, funnily enough, to the stigmatization of hearing loss. And generally, users generally demanded like small or invisible devices to put in their ears. And so in addition to being early adopters, the deaf and hard of hearing people were often the inventors, the retailers and manufacturers of miniaturized electronics. You know, we see so many examples of things that were designed with universal access in mind that have just become completely ubiquitous. Like, you know, speech to text and text to speech were both things that were invented for people with disability. Now everybody's putting these speakers in their house and you can say, you know, hey, Alexa, turn the lights on for me. And you've actually got a world in which universal access was trying to be designed for people with a disability to thank for that. And so some of the best innovations come in areas that you're not looking for because you're trying to design for people that seemingly are a small part of the population. But the intended effect of that innovation isn't necessarily to provide advantage to the wider audience, but it ends up doing it. And when you do that, you become completely unique in an innovative field.
Fantastic. Great answer. Really enjoyed talking to you, Tom. And I can't believe that we're actually going to see each other in person.
Yes.
So for those out there, the Effect series is actually running face-to-face in a number of cities. But if you want to see Tom, he'll be at Sydney on the 2nd of December. And you can register at sap.com/Australia/Effect. That's EFFECT. And it's free to register. Tom, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rushenka. It's been a pleasure.
And you've been listening to the Best Run Podcast, brought to you by SAP.
You've been listening to the Best Run Podcast, brought to you by SAP.